Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
It is heat wave season everywhere.
Ooh, we just got out of a really bad one. I'm so sorry.
We're still in it. I really hope it's raining later today because it is so hot here.
That's the only way that the heat breaks, is if there's a thunderstorm.
Yes. And I looked at my phone the other day and it said that next week it's only going to be 16 degrees, which is really, really chilly. And I was like, there is no way. But I got a little excited. I was like, oh yeah, we're breaking this heat wave. That is 20 degrees less than today. And then I looked a little later and apparently it was some sort of bug because it's not going to get that cold. And I was a little disappointed.
You had my hopes up there. Yes. And my American brain was like, okay, what is 16 plus 32? What is this in our temperature system?
Must be something like 50 degrees.
Oh,
something like that.
Yeah, that's really cool for July.
It's a little chilly. Yes, but it's not happening.
I'm so sorry. At least you have the pool.
Yes. We are at a pool every day. We're either at my in-laws' house or at the, like, public pool, because I cannot take it.
And you have a beautiful balcony now to beat the heat.
Yes. That is lovely.
Oh my gosh, it turned out so well.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad it turned out like this. Now I just have to water the plants, like, 4 times a day, because everything is, like, burning in the heat. And I even take some in just throughout the day so that it doesn't get too insane out there, because our balcony is so sunny and we put up like all the shade, but then I want the majority of the shade to go over the bunnies because it is so hot for them as well. So guess we have to sacrifice. I'll see what's still alive after this summer.
Keeping plants alive in the summer is no joke. I'm honestly really proud of my little herb garden for lasting until almost the 4th of July.
Lovely.
This weekend is always kind of the tipping point of, oh, are things gonna get sunburned? Are they gonna die? But I've been doing really well. I cut back a lot of... The cilantro seems to be very happy, almost too happy. So I cut some back, and then I used some more in taco bowls. Now I need to use up some basil. I have my eye on the parsley, because it seems to have grown around... It seems to have kind of breached the little area that it was planted in.
It's invading the other herbs.
No, the cilantro was very happy. That had the potential to choke other things out, so I was like, okay, I have to cut this back. And I can't let it grow too tall either, because then it will bolt. And parsley and cilantro bolt so quickly.
Yeah, we have so much parsley now. But it's great. I love parsley. We don't have any cilantro because I cannot stand it. I think it's like either you love it or you hate it.
Yeah,
and I really
definitely
I can't do it. It tastes like soap. I can't. I wish I would like it. I really do, because I like Asian food generally. But I can't do the cilantro, and it's in everything.
Do you like rhubarb? Rhubarb's another divisive one.
I really like rhubarb.
See, I'm on the fence about it.
I think, yeah, I like it.
I love it in, like, I love it in a cake.
Yes.
I love it cooked down like strawberries are, but as a coriferous green vegetable, I can't do it. It's so bitter raw.
It is quite bitter. I definitely prefer it in cakes or like syrup, something like that. But I think it's fine raw.
You guys make such cool syrups out of things. You have rhubarb syrup. I bet, like, a really good elderflower, really good lavender.
I love to do that. It's so much fun. I think it is more fun than making jam. I know people love to make jam, but I'm kind of like, the issue is with jam, in my opinion, like, you always make so much that there's no way you're going to eat it. And everyone makes a little extra.
And then you're just giving away jam.
But then, like, I make some extra, but then my mother-in-law also has extra. So we're giving them back and forth. And at the end of the day, it's just so much. Who's going to eat all of it? It always makes me think of when my great-grandfather passed and we were cleaning out his house. We found a jam from 1953. And I was like, it looked so, like, it looked really good still. And I was like, I need to open this. Like, I'm not going to eat it, but I at least have to know.
No.
And so I took it upstairs. I opened it and it smelled fine. I wouldn't try it because, I mean, obviously it was like 60 years old at that point. But I was like, there's no way.
Maybe in like an apocalypse situation.
Before starvation, I would have turned to it. I mean, there's so much sugar in that stuff. I think it just cannot go bad.
We're just talking about this with Twinkies. Why do Twinkies last so long? We don't want to think of this. But
yes.
Anyway, yep. We are a pickling family. Pickles, relish.
Yes.
I love a good pickled beet. I know that's quite divisive as well, but I love a good pickled beet. Yes.
I love it too.
And we can't keep them in the house.
My husband's really into pickling now.
We can't keep them around.
Yeah.
Every time I go visit my grandma, I'm like, Grandma, are you making pickles? Are you making pickled beets? Can I have some?
But anyway, welcome to the second episode of our Beatles Girl miniseries. Yes. Today, I'm beyond excited to share the story of the one that might be the most mysterious Beatles girl. She didn't want to be in the spotlight. She rarely gave any interviews and kept her life as private as possible. She shared a kiss with Paul, married Ringo, and later famously had an affair with George. This is the story of Maureen Cox, a Liverpoolian girl who dreamt of becoming a hairdresser before falling in love with the drums and the drummer and paying the price of loving a Beatle.
Maureen was born Mary Cox on August 4th, 1946 in Liverpool, into the thick of a working-class post-war world. Her father, Joseph, was a ship steward, often away at sea. Her mother, Florence, was a homemaker, reserved and proud. Mary was an only child, observant, bright, a little shy, but full of spark. And she never liked the name Mary. She felt it sounded too plain, too soft. By the time she was a teenager, she started going by Maureen. She said it sounded a little bit more like a celebrity. Even back then, she had the sense that life had something more in store for her. Maureen showed an early streak of rebellion. She once turned her school uniform around to make it look like a dress and paid a friend 10 cigarettes a day to teach her how to smoke properly. By 14, she had left school and began working as a hairdresser and manicurist at Ashley Dupree, a salon in Liverpool. She had a good eye, steady hands, a confident style. She wore her hair in big beehives and followed all the latest fashion trends. Now, everyone knew her as Maureen, though friends called her Mo, or sometimes Mitch. Cute nicknames.
Yeah. And she would call Ringo Richie, which I think is so sweet.
I read that.
Yeah.
It's so cute. Like many teens in Liverpool, Maureen became swept up in the Merseybeat music scene, and of course, the Cavern Club was the best place in town to hear it. Mo was what would be known as a dedicated audience member, but before she went out with a Beatle, she dated another musician. His name was John Byrne, but everyone knew him as Johnny Guitar, co-founder of Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. Ringo Starr. Mo and Johnny didn't last, but Mo continued spending her nights at the Cavern, where she soon saw Ringo's new band, the Beatles.
Okay, this is it. The Beatles sing Some Other Guy.
She would sneak away from the salon with her friends to see them play, braving the long lines and frenzied competition to get close. Even though this was years before Beatlemania really took hold, the Beatles had a certain effect on the girls. Many of them were loyal fans coming out every day to see them perform. Maureen later recalled the atmosphere at the Cavern, quote, "They used to hang around the Cavern all day long on the off chance of seeing them. They'd come out of the lunchtime session and just stand outside all afternoon queuing up for the evening. The object was to get as near to the front row as possible so that they could see the Beatles and be seen. I never joined the queue until about 2 or 3 hours before the Cavern opened. It frightened me. There would be fights and rows among the girls. When it got near the time for the Beatles to come in, they would go off in turns to the lavatory with their little cases to get changed and made up. So when the Beatles came on, they'd look smashing, as if they'd just arrived. One night, on a dare, Mo kissed Paul McCartney outside the club, but her real favorite was Ringo. She waited around and managed to kiss him too. Over time, Ringo began to recognize her face. She once asked him for his autograph in the street and jotted down his license plate number, but it took another 3 weeks for him to really notice her. Eventually, he asked her to dance at the Cavern, and from there, the relationship began. They kept things quiet at first. Mo was 16, a teenage hairdresser in love with a drummer who was set to become one of the most famous men in the world.
Once word spread that she was dating Ringo, Maureen became the target of vicious jealousy. On Valentine's Day of 1963, she was attacked outside Liverpool's Locarno Ballroom, her face scratched by an angry fan. She barely managed to roll up the car window in time to avoid further injury. Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, insisted the band appear single to fans to keep the mania alive. Although Ringo wasn't necessarily hiding her, Maureen still bore the brunt of the public's aggression. Dating a Beatle came with a cost, and Maureen paid it in silence. The devoted fans, especially the more obsessive ones, didn't take kindly to seeing their Ringo with someone real. Maureen became a target, hissed at, harassed, even physically attacked. Quote, "I might have been killed otherwise," she later said. So she learned to disappear, disguising herself with scarves and sunglasses, and always using back entrances. She didn't want to be in the spotlight, something she bonded over with Cynthia. Maureen and Cynthia were both Liverpudlian girls through and through, and that bond helped them form a deep friendship that would last nearly 30 years. In 1963, Ringo was planning a trip to Greece with Paul McCartney, who was then dating Jane Asher. Naturally, he wanted Maureen to come along. She was just 16 at the time, and the idea of traveling abroad with her boyfriend was irresistible. A sun-soaked holiday in Greece? Of course she said yes. She didn't tell her parents. She knew they'd never allow their teenage daughter to jet off to a foreign country with a pop star boyfriend. But Maureen was headstrong and unafraid to follow her heart. She quietly slipped away from home and made her way to Greece. It sounds wild now, sneaking out of the country at 16, but Maureen was always a bit of a rebel.
I snuck out a time or two, but I never made it across the border into another country.
I mean, it is wild, but I don't know. I mean, I guess if the opportunity would have been there, maybe I would have.
What was the farthest you made
I'm wondering, like Austria maybe? Just for a weekend?
Okay, that's still another country.
Yes, I mean, it's close, but it is another country. What about you?
Oh gosh, I made it out to Boston, which is only 2 hours in change from where I grew up, but still, kind of wild that I made it there and back on a school night and nobody ever knew.
That is really great. It reminds me of, like, when I was in 10th grade or something, one of my classmates, she was seeing someone who was, like, significantly older and involved with politics. Like, he was a quite well-known politician. We knew him from the news and shit. Yes. And she was like, you cannot make this up. She was leaving her parents' house in the morning, told them she'd go to school, take a train.
Excuse me?
Go there, spend the day with him. Come back all in time, and it took her parents like 2 years to figure this out. Yep, it was wild. I don't think like the public Jesus ever found Christ. Out about this, because it would have been such a scandal. Because she was very, like, she was a minor. She was like 16 or so, and he was like 30 something. It is so creepy to think about it. But back then, it, like, I thought about this the other day, because I thought about baby groupies. That's and I was really like, bad. Back then when she told me about this, I didn't consider that this wild. I was like, okay, you do you.
But now that we're a little closer to age 30 and we realize that 16-year-olds are like children. Yes,
it is so creepy.
What would you even have in common with a 16-year-old?
I don't want to know. Nothing. Yeah, it's so, so strange.
I think this is honestly not the worst opportunity to bring up this slight age gap between Maureen and Ringo. Maureen was 16-ish when they started seeing each other. How old would Ringo have been in 1963? I'm not great with the math.
Like 20, I think. He's a couple years older. It's not that much, but it is a lot. Like, it is crazy to see how young she was thrown into all of this. Then on the other side, she left school at 14, which, like, when she was 16, I had, like, a hard time wrapping my head around this almost, because at 16, she was already working for 2 years. So she was already, I don't want to say an adult by any means, but she wasn't, like, a schoolgirl anymore. She was well into doing more responsible things.
She had adult responsibilities.
Yes, and Ringo wasn't, like, 40. He was 20, so...
Yes, Ringo was not 40.
So I don't think...
So they have some things in common.
Yes, I don't think that that age gap is too controversial, and I also think it was way more common back then. However, I think it is a lot. If someone would tell me now I'm 20 and I'm dating a 16-year-old, I would probably be like, that's weird.
How the times have changed.
Once the press caught wind of the trip, the story exploded. Photographs of her vacationing with Ringo made headlines, and her parents were eventually tracked down for comment. Imagine having reporters knock on your door and being like, is this your 16-year-old daughter with a rock star in a foreign country? And you're like, I'm sorry, what?
Oh my god. Oh my god. Excuse me?
Her father, rather than expressing outrage, admitted that Maureen couldn't have been stopped. Quote, it really did not surprise my wife or myself when we learned that she was halfway across the world. In any case, it wouldn't have made any difference. I would have given her permission anyway. Maureen is a sensible girl and well able to take care of herself. That trip and the attention it drew marked a turning point. By 1964, Maureen was no longer just a Liverpoolian teenager. She was known globally as Ringo Starr's girlfriend. As Ringo's fame grew, he relocated to London, while Maureen stayed behind in Liverpool with her parents, still working at the salon. In May of 1964, the two took another holiday, this time to the Caribbean, again with Paul and Jane. All of these trips were wonderful, but the pressure of Beatlemania started weighing heavy on their relationship. Later that year, Ringo decided to end things. The demands of his career left little room for romance, but then fate stepped in. During a photo session in London, Ringo collapsed with a 102-degree fever and tonsillitis. Maureen rushed to his side, bringing ice cream and staying through the holidays to care for him. Their time together in that hospital room changed everything. The bond between them only deepened.
It seems this health scare was just what Ringo needed to realize Mo was the girl for him. A few weeks after he recovered, in January of 1965, he proposed. Maureen, of course, said yes. This was her dream come true. On February 11th, they married in a small, quiet ceremony at Caxton Hall in London. Maureen, now 18, wore a simple ivory suit. Ringo was 24. Okay, we gotta put our math caps on right now.
So it's 6 years.
So 16 and 22.
Yes.
All right.
That's a little... It's iffy, I want to say.
George, John and Cynthia, and Brian Epstein were there, along with a few family members. Paul and Jane couldn't attend, they were on vacation. For Maureen and Ringo, it marked the formal beginning of their lives together. They had a short honeymoon at the vacation home of Brian Epstein's lawyer in Hove, but were followed by over 100 members of the press. On their wedding day, they gave an impromptu interview in the garden. This is one of the very few interviews with Maureen. We'll include an excerpt about here.
Congratulations too, okay. Mrs. Starkey.
I'm still not used to that yet, you know.
Are you really going to get a honeymoon?
No, I don't think so. Not with the likes of you chaps around.
No, are you thinking of a honeymoon?
Well, this was supposed to be it, but it didn't work.
Well, for how long was it supposed to be?
Well, I have to start work on Monday, so I was going back Sunday or Monday, you know.
Do you expect your marriage?
John and George were at the wedding, and they were made up, you know. They're happy, but we don't know about Paul yet, because he's away on holiday.
He hasn't been in contact. Did he know you were getting married?
No.
Where is he?
He's away.
Do you know where?
Yes, but I'm not telling you. Well, he might as well have a bit of peace. I'm not getting it.
Presumably met Ringo before the group were very successful, did
yes.
you?
Yes.
Did you expect he was going to become a public monument like this?
Well, in Liverpool I did. Yeah. I didn't think sort of more or less all over the world, you know.
Does that worry you, that the fact that, you know, you can't go anywhere with him?
No, not really. I just sort of enjoy myself.
Do you intend to keep out the limelight, like Mrs. Lennon, for example, John Lennon's
wife? Well, I don't like reporters and things.
She's on our side.
Their eldest son, Zach, was born in September of 1965, 8 months after their wedding. There are photos from that time, Maureen glowing with pride, cradling baby Zach, and she looks radiant. But beyond the looks and the sweetness of a growing family, it's interesting how people zero in on Cynthia Lennon's pregnancy, speculating that's why she married John. Maureen doesn't get the same treatment, despite her and Ringo's love story following a similar arc in this respect. The truth is, yes, pregnancy may have hurried the timeline. That's how the times were back then. If someone was pregnant, you just got married. But both women deeply loved their Beatles. They wouldn't have put up with the nonsense otherwise. These weren't marriages of convenience. They were built on love.
I think this is like a coin with two sides. There's like the side that was Cynthia Lennon's way into marriage, which is you're pregnant, you have to get married. And I think for Maureen and Ring...
But it was John's idea.
Yes, but like it was also expected in a way. Like when someone was pregnant, you were expected to get married. And I think for Maureen and Ringo, it was the other way around. Because once you got married, you were expected to have a kid. So it almost didn't matter what was there first, because one thing back in the 60s rarely came without the other.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll talk a little bit about that in the next episode, actually. The expectations to have a family once you're married.
Because it weighed heavy on those who couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Maureen quietly stepped back from her hairdressing career, something that was also expected of women at the time, and embraced life as a full-time wife and mother at home. She wasn't interested in chasing fame. She preferred quiet routines to red carpets and poured her energy into caring for Ringo and their growing family. In fact, during late-night studio sessions, she would often stay up waiting for him to come home just so he'd have a warm meal ready and someone to talk to at the end of the day. This was the kind of woman Mo was, devoted, steady, endlessly giving. And for someone like Ringo, constantly in motion, constantly being watched but with this big sensitive heart, that kind of love must have felt like a harbor. Maureen gave Ringo safety, a sense of home, and he adored her. But he was also a man with deep insecurities. As Mo once explained, Richie isn't assertive at all. He's pretty laid back and gentle. Some people would call him a pushover. He has this inferiority complex about him. He just wants me to constantly reassure him that I love him because he gets afraid. We would be lying in bed and he would hold me close and say, "Do you really love me?" I think he was really pleased to hear me say that to him. He was so afraid that I might not love him. Despite those nagging feelings, which would grow later, Mo remained loyal. She loved Ringo's softness, his sense of humor, and his charm with children. Quote, "Richie is such a cheerful, peaceful man that it's wonderful to talk with him. He has a wonderful sense of humor that can be very charming at times. My mother loved him when she first met him because he charmed the socks off her. He was excellent with children, mostly because he's usually gentle and playful. I used to comment to him that he still acted like a child, but he laughed it off.
Their home in Weybridge was just down the road from John and Cynthia's. It was quiet, green, private, and perfect for raising children, but sometimes it could be lonely too. Ringo was away constantly, touring, filming, recording. Maureen stayed back with the kids. By 1967, they had welcomed their second son, Jason. Their daughter, Lee, followed in 1970. From the outside, it looked like a charmed life, wealth, children, fame, but Maureen was often left alone, carrying the weight of the family by herself. Still, she made their house a haven. Friends say she was grounded and funny, with a dry wit and a disarming warmth. She found comfort in the Beatles' wives, Cynthia Lennon, Patti Boyd, Jane Asher, women who understood the strange duality of being adored by millions, yet totally invisible. Cynthia and Maureen, in particular, had a strong bond. They leaned on each other, confided in one another, and found sisterhood in the chaos. As Cynthia wrote, quote, "Far from being a shy little thing, Maureen was talkative, full of laughter, and great fun. We all liked her enormously and thought she was good for Ringo. Maureen, who was one of the most down, honest people I ever knew, became my closest friend." Maureen never sought the spotlight. When she wanted to pick up working again, she answered Ringo's fan mail, quietly, from the kitchen table. She had once dreamed of opening her own salon, and Ringo had even promised to help her launch a nationwide hairdressing business, but it never happened. However, Maureen was happy. She never resented the life she and Ringo had built, at least not openly. She stayed committed, even as the cracks in their marriage deepened. In the late 60s, she got a little more involved with the Beatles' work. She was the one that hand-sewed all those tiny sequins onto their legendary Sgt. Pepper costumes. What would you think if I sang out a tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing. She also left her mark in their music. If you listen to The Continuing Story of Bungalow Bill on the White Album, you'll hear her singing in the chorus with Yoko and Patty. Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Once you know it's them, it's so obvious, those soft, playful voices in the background. And if you've ever seen Get Back, you might have spotted her during the rooftop concert. Most of the people up there were part of the crew, but sitting quietly to the side were Yoko, Chris O'Dell, and Maureen. She moves to the music, her hair flowing in the wind. At the end of Get Back, someone shouts, "Woohoo!" and claps, and Paul says, "Thanks, Mo." That was her. That little cheer, just a small, sweet moment, but it says everything. She was always there, just off to the side, softly cheering them on. By the late 1960s, Ringo's drinking had worsened. The infidelity started. The Beatles were drifting apart, and so was he. But Maureen, still in her early 20s, with three young children, stood by him, forgave him, and kept going. In 1968, she dyed her hair blonde and joined Ringo and the rest of the Beatles and their girlfriends in Rishikesh, India, for their now legendary retreat with the Maharishi. Maureen tried to embrace it, the meditation, the peaceful setting, the escape. She wore bright tunics and wandered barefoot through the ashram gardens. But she missed home. She missed her cats. She missed Liverpool. In letters to friends, she admitted it wasn't really her scene. India was beautiful, but not quite where she belonged. During the late 60s, the Beatles' lifestyle grew darker and more chaotic. It was an era of cocaine, heavier drugs, and heavy drinking. It was a difficult time for Maureen, watching Ringo spiral, caught in the whirlwind of it all.
I think this would be a good time to open the floor and talk about Ringo quitting the band during White Album sessions. In this time, he went on vacation with Mo and their children. For them, India was not the restful experience it was for everyone else. Ringo ran out of food to eat. Mo was homesick and terrified of bugs. The White Album sessions everything going on there, it put a lot of stress on all of the marriages. Like, Cynthia and John split up. Yeah. Jane and Paul split up. Towards the end, George and Patty are starting to have their first issues. And there was a lot of stress on Ringo and Maureen as well.
Yeah. We touched on this last week because Ringo really made a comeback from this. And he has been really yes. open about the fact that he was, I'm just going to use his words, he was like mm-hmm. an asshole, basically. He said that about himself. He said that he didn't treat his wife right. He didn't care much for their children. And that he also always expressed how tremendously thankful he was for Maureen, because she really mm-hmm. stepped up and she took on all the responsibilities. And I think it is important to acknowledge that he has stood up to his mistakes. He has earned up to them. But yet, I think it is important to understand that the Ringo she was living with at that time wasn't the fun, entertaining Ringo that you see in interviews. He was drinking. He wasn't showing up. He had affairs after affairs. She knew it. Mm. It must have been really, really hard for her. And he was under such stress of the with the band and everything. And he definitely put that on her as well.
He was the anchor of the Beatles. I stand by this. He was the eternal optimist. Yes. He was the buffer between all that was going on with the other three personalities. He had such a heavy load to bear.
He really kept them grounded. He was so perfect, I think, in my opinion, for the Beatles, because these were such big personalities, and Ringo was someone who would always try to find like a solution, who was always mediating between whoever was fighting at the moment. That's why I don't like when people say that he was like a less important Beatle, because I believe without Ringo, they would have never even made it this far.
Yeah. Being the rock is a really heavy load to bear, and though the cracks might not have shown in his relationship with the Beatles, at least publicly, it did show privately in his family life. He was kind of a rock star as far as birthdays went. I think this is my favorite story here.
This is the best story I've ever heard about a birthday. Yes.
For Moe's 22nd birthday in 1968, Ringo went above and beyond. He reached out to Frank Sinatra, Moe's childhood idol. Blue Eyes recorded a private version of The Lady is a Tramp, retitled The Lady is a Champ, especially for her. Sammy Kahn rewrote the lyrics. She married Ringo, and she could have had Paul. That's why the lady is a champ. This one-of-a-kind recording was pressed as Apple One, the very first Apple Records pressing before Hey Jude. Only one copy was ever made, given to Mo. The masters were destroyed. Collectors consider this one of the rarest, most valuable records ever made. Even outside of Beatles Holy Grails, a Sinatra and Beatles crossover so rare, there's one of one. No commercial copies exist, but you can hear a bootleg on YouTube.
There's no one like her, but no one at all. And as for charm, hers is like wall to wall. She married Ringo, and she could have had Paul. That's why the lady is a champ.
With the Beatles unraveling and eventually breaking up, Ringo became increasingly unreliable, drinking heavily. He took his personal problems out on his wife and later admitted in a 1992 interview, quote, "I was a drunk. I was a wife beater and an absent father. I never hit anybody I didn't mean to hit." That was Ringo taking full ownership for the abuse his alcoholism put his family through. Drinking fathers are not present fathers.
Yeah. And I think he really made up. Like, he really tried his best and he put a lot of effort into stepping up and like being there for his kids for the rest of, like, mainly the 80s, the late 70s. He really tried, but I like how he I think he knows that he cannot make up for this.
I like that he didn't try and excuse domestic violence with, oh, I was just really drunk.
No, he really, I think this is the way to apologize. This is like the best way to just be like, okay, I'm sorry, I fucked this up, it was bad.
Took accountability. Yes,
he did that. And that is, I think, why he is now not as put in the box there as other people are.
John.
Yeah.
Ringo had had affairs. But when their marriage was in a crisis period, Mo had an affair that caused a scandal. This remains one of the most whispered about chapters in Beatle history because Mo had an affair with none other than George Harrison. At first, the signs were subtle. Mo started visiting Friar Park late at night under the pretense of listening in the studio. She'd stay until morning. She wore a necklace George had given her. Patty came back from visiting her mother once to find Maureen not only in her house, but flaunting her place there, when Patty finally confronted them, knocking on the bedroom door and finding Mo on a mattress, George just said, "She's a bit tired. She's having a rest." No shame, no apology. Patty and George's marriage wasn't going well either. We will go into much more detail in a future episode. But if you'll remember from our episode about Chris O'Dell, George made a habit of coming on to Patty's friends basically because he could. And Mo was one of Patty's closest friends. That betrayal was their marriage's final straw. She never would have expected her to go behind her back like this.
Must have been so heartbreaking. To me, I mean, I don't want to judge because I think it was horrible for both women. But for me, this situation feels worse than the Yoko and Cynthia situation. Because at least these two weren't friends. Like, it was, the betrayal was mainly on John's part there. What, I mean, sure, you can say, whether you know the woman or not, you know the man's married, you don't do that. Yes, fully accept that. Absolutely behind that. But I think it is 10 times worse when it's your friend's husband.
I think we're also going to see this in a future episode, but I think this was able to happen between George and Maureen because Mo was very lonely. We heard about this again in the episode about Chris O'Dell. When Ringo was making the Magic Christian, right? And hanging out with Harry Nilsson and drinking up and down LA all week long. Mo and Chris would just hang out together. They would smoke all day. They would just sit around. Chris was having a really tough time as well with her addiction. Misery loves company.
We don't have to talk about the fact that obviously you don't do that. And this was just a mistake that Maureen and George made. Yep. But I do think we have to talk about the circumstances that led to this and just to for people to understand that this wasn't like two happy marriages and then these two started like making out. You have to understand that both of their marriages were at a breaking point basically even before this. This wasn't like the one thing that broke off two perfect marriages.
By Christmas, the affair was no longer hidden. George and Maureen disappeared in broad daylight while session musicians waited in his studio. Patty saw it clearly. They wanted her to know that this was happening. She tried to warn Ringo at a party, but he got furious and refused to believe it. Until the next night, when they all sat around a dinner table at Tidhurst, Ringo and Maureen's home. Chris O'Dell recalls this fateful night in her biography.
"I'd never been to Tidhurst before. It was night and the middle of winter, so I couldn't see the grounds. I'd heard that the gorgeous Georgian manor house, which a colonel had sold to Ringo, was surrounded by 72 landscaped acres. But inside, the house looked so cheery, with a fire crackling in the living room and the dark lampshades creating little pools of light around the room. Toys were scattered about on the floor, and good kitchen smells, dinner for the kids most likely, filled the house. Tidhurst had a warmth and glow to it that made me want to settle right down into the comfy, overstuffed furniture. It was such a contrast to the majestic magnificence of Friar Park." We sat at the long wooden table in the kitchen, Ringo and George on one bench, Patty and I facing them on the opposite bench. Maureen spent the entire evening flitting around like a little bird, landing here, then there, jumping up to cook an omelette for Ringo, refilling our drinks, bringing plates of food to the table. At one point, Maureen went to a side table, opened the drawer, and pulled out a packet of Marlboros. George's brand. Maureen and Ringo both smoked Larks. George looked up at her as she put the cigarettes on the table next to his hand and smiled. Nobody said a word. I could hear the tick of the clock on the kitchen wall. We sat there in silence. And then George turned to Ringo and said, "You know, Ringo, I'm in love with your wife." I think all five hearts in that kitchen stopped beating for a few seconds. The room was completely still. No sudden gasps, no deep breaths, no fingers tapping or throats clearing. Absolute silence. I looked down, feeling so cold and indifferent to the feelings. How could he have said that at the table, waiting if not to hurt her, at least to be indifferent to her feelings? To say those words in front of her, in front of all of us. Maureen retreated to the far side of the room and stood by the sink, frozen, staring at the kitchen counter. Ringo looked down at the table. He flicked his cigarette ash in the ashtray. His jaw clenched and a muscle by his mouth twitched. We sat there, waiting. Finally, he looked at George. "Better you than someone we don't know," he said in a steady voice. I looked at Patty. Her eyes were white and unblinking. "This can't be real," she must have been thinking. "This can't be real." I gently touched her arm. "Patty, let's go into the other room." She nodded as we stood up and walked away from the others into Maureen's little sitting room at the front of the house. I looked around, surprised, even a bit shocked. Filled with Indian tapestries, pillows and candles, the air thick with incense, the room locked as if Maureen had decorated it specifically for George. "There you are," Maureen said, walking into the room as if she had been looking all over the house for us. "Would you like something more to drink?" We had another drink or two, and our conversation was civil and polite, as if nothing at all had happened. That was Sunday night, January 1st of 1974. Monday passed, and not a word from either of them. Then, on Tuesday morning at 4:30, the phone rang. "Chris," Maureen said, speaking in a very soft voice, almost a whisper, as if she were trying to hide the phone call from Ringo. "Things have gone awful here. Can I come to you?" "Of course you can," I said, finally finding my voice. "What happened?" "I'll tell you when I get there." I gave her my address, and half an hour later, she showed up at my apartment. We talked for hours, sitting at the table in my living room, smoking one cigarette after another, drinking cup after cup of tea. I had never seen Maureen in distress before. She was always strong. "It's bloody awful," she said. We yelled and screamed at each other. "I'm so sorry, Maureen," I said. "I wish I could make it all go away." She waved her hand at me as if to say, "Oh, don't worry about that. I've got other things to think about right now." She did talk about George, about her relationship with him, and notably, she vehemently denied having had a full-on relationship with him. And not once did she admit that she might have done anything to take responsibility for the damage to her marriage. I'm not judging her, because I truly believe she considered her relationship with George a fling without any lasting significance. Ringo was the true love of her life. "I know the situation got us here," she said, "but that's not what's keeping me and Richie apart. He's just so angry. He won't listen. He won't talk to me." I tried to console her. Maybe after they'd both had some time to calm down and think, they'd be able to find a way to get back together again. "I don't know, Chris. I don't know," she said. "This is bad, really bad." She took a sip of tea and looked at me with those dark eyes, her thick makeup smudged from tears and lack of sleep, as if to ask, "How could it ever be good again?" She lit another cigarette. "And what about the children?" she said, exhaling deeply. "How am I going to protect the children?" There it was again, that tone of despair and defeat. And yet, she had her children. They were her refuge. "I need to get back to the children," she said, in a tone of desperation in her voice. We called the airlines, and she booked a flight to England, leaving later that day.
Chris is such a fantastic storyteller.
Yes, this reads like a novel.
The news broke about the affair, and it was messy. John Lennon later called the affair virtual incest. Mo had been in the Beatles' orbit for over 10 years, and John considered her family, just like George. The affair was a breaking point for both the Starkeys and Harrison's marriages. Ringo and Mo tried to patch things up for the sake of their kids. They smiled for the cameras, attended parties, went through the motions. But something had broken, and no amount of pretending could put it back together. Mo never spoke publicly about the affair. She never defended herself. Never told her side. Those close to her say she was racked with guilt. She hadn't stopped loving Ringo, but she couldn't take it anymore. This wasn't the man she married anymore. He was a stranger to her. George offered a momentary escape, and in a moment of weakness, she took it. Still, Mo and Ringo stayed together for a while longer, clinging to what was left, but the damage was done. In 1975, Ringo asked for a divorce. Maureen, devastated and deeply humiliated, resisted at first. She had been with Ringo since she was 16 years old, her entire adult life. She didn't know anything else. But Ringo had already moved on and started dating model and photographer Nancy Lee Andrews. Eventually, Mo accepted the divorce. She was granted custody of the children and received a settlement, £125,000 up front, £23,000 annually, and another £2,500 per child each year. Mo tried to keep it together for her kids, but the pain of losing her husband was too much for her to handle. She was 27 and a single mother of three, and had spent all this time so far tending to her husband's needs. It felt like her life was falling apart. In the aftermath, Mo vanished from the spotlight. She didn't give interviews, she didn't write a memoir, she never sold her story. But those close to her knew something was wrong. Cynthia Lennon later revealed the depths of her despair. Quote, "When Mo and Ringo parted in 1974, she had been so heartbroken that she got on a motorbike and drove it straight into a brick wall, badly injuring herself. It was a miracle she survived. Maureen had plastic surgery from the accident. She told friends she loved the result and that she thought it made her look better. But the wounds were deeper than physical." Over a decade later, in 1987, Maureen sued her divorce lawyers for negligence, claiming they hadn't investigated Ringo's finances properly. When testifying, she famously said, quote, "I'm thick as two short planks." She also referred to Ringo as a sodding great Andy Cap, referencing the drinking husband from the Andy Cap comic strip. But the court sided with Ringo, calling him generous, especially since he had increased her payments after the divorce. Maureen was ordered to pay over £200,000 in legal fees. The press pounced. Even then, she didn't make a formal statement. Somehow, through the 80s, Ringo and Mo made up. When their son Zach had his first child, they became grandparents together. There was still love between them, not romantic love, but a deep, enduring affection. The kind that survives infidelity and public divorce and still manages to show up at birthdays and holidays. And Ringo did what he had to do. Years later, he apologized. He said, quote, "I don't want to be that person anymore," and worked to change. He apologized publicly and privately to Mo. Mo found love again. In the early 80s, she began dating Isaac Tigret, co-founder of the Hard Rock Cafe and House of Blues chains. They were married in Monaco on May 27, 1989. Isaac once quoted her as saying, "If you give me furs and jewelry, I'll be happy," and oddly, he referred to her as his ultimate collectible. I guess there's no greater piece of rock and roll history than being married to the ex-wife of a Beatle.
Yep. It's so odd. It's such a weird thing to say. I'm sorry, I know he meant it in like a charming way, but it's so odd. In
a sweet way, but it just comes off so weird. Right idea, exact wrong execution. But it is a little, to me, it more reads as like, "Oh, this is my wife, the greatest prize of my life."
Yeah, that too, but also just,
it comes off so strange.
Also, I want to apologize if it is really loud. It started pouring outside and I'm so excited, but that might make it a little louder in the background.
Oh, it's all right. We have the tree crews at the end of the street. I can hear them. And they will probably be in this audio track. Still, Mo and Isaac seemed very happy, and they had a daughter named Augusta. With Isaac, she helped develop the House of Blues charity. She worked quietly behind the scenes, just like any other volunteer would. One of her former colleagues recalled how she would, quote, show up to meetings in jeans, no makeup, and a wicked sense of humor. A far cry from furs and jewelry. She didn't need the room to revolve around her. She just wanted to do something meaningful.
By the early 1990s, Maureen's life took a tragic turn. At a House of Blues opening, she fainted. Misdiagnosed at first with anemia, doctors later found out she had a form of leukemia called myelodysplasia. She was only in her 40s, and her health was deteriorating quickly. She sought treatment at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. When the illness worsened, Ringo dropped everything to be by her side. He flew to Seattle and he stayed. He slept in the hospital by her side and held her hand. He took care of the children. Those who were there said that Ringo never left her, not even for a moment. And it wasn't just obligation, it was love, the kind that doesn't end when the romance does. When her condition became critical, Ringo led a worldwide appeal for bone marrow donors. Fans, strangers, musicians, thousands responded. Her son Zach was a match and donated his bone marrow to try and save her, but her body was already too weak.
On December 30th, 1994, Maureen Starkey passed away at the age of 48. She was with her four children, her mother, Isaac, and Ringo. Ringo later said Mo was, quote, the most important woman of my life. He was lucky enough to find the second great love of his life, Barbara, but he always had love for Mo. She was the first to believe in him. Though they had everything as a Mr. and Mrs. Beetle, she never asked for anything but love in return for her own. At her funeral, he wept openly. Zach, Jason, and Lee stood beside him. Paul, George, Patty, and Cynthia all attended the service. Nearly everyone was there, their whole tangled, beautiful, broken Beetle family. Maureen's ashes were divided amongst her children, some scattered in the Santa Barbara Botanical Gardens. Augusta, her youngest child with Isaac, was just 7 years old. She later said she remembered her mother's laugh, the warmth of her hugs, the smell of her perfume, a soft, clean scent that clung to her sweaters long after she was gone. Zach, her firstborn, carried his parents' rhythm forward. He played with Oasis, until this year he toured with The Who, and carved a legacy of his own.
Paul McCartney, the man who always comes off as the hero in all of these stories so far, later wrote a song in her memory titled Little Willow, which appeared on his 1997 album Flaming Pie. He had dedicated it to her children.
Bend, little willow, wind's gonna blow you hot and cold tonight. Life as it happens, nobody warns you, willow, hold on tight. Nothing's gonna shake your love, take your love away. No one's out to break your heart, it only seems that way. Hey.
Maureen Cox was never on the cover of a record. She didn't write a memoir or pose for the cameras. But without her, there would have never been a home for Ringo to come back to. No steady rhythm behind the chaos of the 60s. She was part of the quiet machinery that made the magic possible. She had loved a Beatle and then forgave one. She raised three children in a world that never gave her privacy or peace. And she did it with open arms and an open heart. This is why we remember her, not just for who she loved, but for how she loved. Her daughter, Augusta, later said, quote, one thing is that every person I speak to, no matter if it's someone's grandpa or Sting or Trudy Styler, they all say she was the kindest, most accepting person they ever knew, and on one or many occasions made them feel welcome when no one else would. She would invite them to sit at her table and make them feel loved and respected.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of Maureen Starkey. Thanks, Mo.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.